Good morning.
Good morning.
Today is Saturday, May 17, 2008, and I'm now sitting with Pawani Reddy, who works with the UN Development Program, as well as the Ministry of Gender of the Government of Liberia. We're now in Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. Well, first, thank you for your time. And before we start the interview, can you please confirm that you've given your consent to this interview?
Yes, I've given my consent. I'm not being coerced.
All right. Well, I'd like to start by learning more about your personal background, the positions you held before coming here, and particularly what's does your current position with the NDP and the Ministry of Gender entails.
Okay. Before this, I was I graduated from university in anthropology, and I worked for a year in Rwanda as an intern program assistant for CARE, which was basically an assistant to the deputy country director of programs. And was pure arts development advocacy work. Here in Liberia, I am the civil society officer for UNDP, and I've been seconded to the Ministry of Gender for the last 10 months to be their technical assistant on policy and PRS.
So, as civil society officer for UNDP in the Ministry of Gender, what part of what is your mandate first, and how does your mandate relate to security sector reform in Liberia?
The mandate with the Ministry of Gender is basically provide the technical assistance to the minister and the ministry needs in terms of various policies, and also in terms of mainstreaming gender in the PRS development, as well as now in the implementation of PRS. And that's where
the poverty reduction strategy.
Well, the one of the main pillar areas for the poverty reduction strategy's priority areas is the national security sector. So mainstreaming gender in the national security sector, thus became one of the priority issues that I worked on in the last 9-10 months.
Okay. What are the key elements of this first pillar, national security sector, in your domain, in terms of gender?
The first elements, as in what we proposed in terms of mainstreaming gender?
Yeah, what are the key challenges that have been identified in the process of designing the PRS, and that are actually in the document?
I think the two key challenges that we identified in terms of mainstreaming gender, both in terms of increasing the number of women in the security sector, as well as making the services offered by the security sector much more gender-friendly or people-friendly, those were the two sort of focus areas. So it's both institutional reform and as well as an operational reform that we were proposing. The biggest challenge in proposing that kind of reform, surprisingly, was not the reluctance or an argument from the security sector, but rather the lack of knowledge of the implication of what it is that we are proposing. So what would, if suppose we sat across the table and said, we do want the 33% representation, we want a gender capacity building officer in all of the security sectors, be it Ministry of Defense, AFL, LNP, we want a gender officer stationed in each of these security sectors, and whose main role would be to build the capacity of women police officers in the rank and file so that they can raise to the higher level and be decision makers as well. They agreed to it. I mean, at least it's in the PRS right now. So basically that means that they agreed to it. But I don't think they understand the implication of implementing something like this. And also when we have sat around in meetings with the Ministry of Defense, LNP uses accelerated learning program to have
the Liberia National Police.
The Liberia National Police has there's a program called Accelerated Learning Program, where in qualified women who have not completed their high school diploma are given an opportunity to finish the course through an accelerated learning program, and then they're sent to the police academy for training. LNP, the program has been quite successful. I think they have about more than 10% of the officers currently trained are women, and also they are increasing quite a few. How do you put it? I mean, at least they're looking at reaching at least 20 to 30% in the near future. But the problem with AFL right now, I think the ratio of women in AFL, the armed forces of Liberia, is about 5.6, maybe even less.
5.6.
And one of the main reasons for that is because the Ministry of Defense considers anyone going through accelerated learning program of being of a less caliber than anyone who has a normal education. And one of the arguments is that they want all the officers in the army now to be of a certain caliber. They don't want a repeat of the last 20 years, and they want good officers.
What are the minimum requirements to enter the army in terms of education?
I think that you may need to have a proper high school diploma.
So similar to the police.
Yeah, and then depending on whether if you're going to be an officer training, then I think you would need to have hold a degree as well.
So when has this accelerated education program for future female LNP officer been first discussed? How has the idea of a quota of 20% female as a target for the LNP, how was it brought about, and what was the context and maybe the background for this discussion?
That's a good question, because the accelerated learning program, I think, started way back when Mission came in as well, because they wanted to have, when this restructuring of LNP was taking place, that they did want to have gender balance in the recruits, and that's when they felt that there's an entire generation that's lost out on education in the country. And that's when to have more women that they devised this accelerated learning program. And that accelerated learning program has been going on, I'm tempted to say since 2004, but I could be wrong. But I think you need to verify who, what year it has started and how many women have been targeted through the accelerated learning program. I don't have the exact figures.
Before we come back to the security sector, what are some of the broader sort of societal challenges in terms of gender? You mentioned the army sort of reluctance to have an accelerated program, but what are the broader challenges here in Liberia in terms of gender issues?
I think the biggest is the personal crime against women. The extent of gender-based violence here, particularly rape, is just to an epidemic proportion. So that really hinders any kind of basic development and security, the sense of security women feel. Having said that, it's all the rest, of course. The 2 decades of war, there's not enough money, there's people lost out on education, all of the other development challenges that come with in a country like this. But I think violence against women, as well as their lower status in the counties, is the biggest problem that we face right now. And it's widespread. I mean, there's one clinic, I don't know if you've heard about it, Benson Clinic, which is basically treated as a rape center. And they have, on a daily basis, at least 10, they treat about 10 children ranging from 1 month to 10 years old to 12.
So cases of rape against children?
Children, women. It's very, very widespread. I mean, for example, in the National Women's Conference we had last week, time and again, the issue of protection and security came up, and that women identified as the biggest concern to them. They don't know what to do if other women have gone through rape and other forms of violence in the society. There's no support network, no structures that are established. And of course, the other things, of course, land, access to land, that's a huge issue because there's a traditional customary practices in terms of land distribution in the counties. It's not through civil procedures, and it's allocated to people, and usually women don't inherit the land, but it's once a husband dies, the land can be taken from the woman and given to someone. And they have passed the inheritance law in 2005, saying that the spouses have equal rights in terms of inheriting land as well. But that has been, I mean, the knowledge of the inheritance law and the application of inheritance law has been quite minimal since 2005, I think. And there's a law against gang rape from 2005 as well.
So the rationale for the accelerated education program implemented in the case of the police and proposed in the case of the army was that women did not have as easy access to education.
Not just women. It's everyone didn't have an access to education. I mean, you have two decades of war. There's basically no infrastructure outside of Monrovia. Every single school system has been destroyed. I mean, right now, the biggest crisis in the country is education crisis. They don't have enough teachers to go around, and they have quote-unquote volunteer teachers who are not basically any more educated than the children that they teach. And that's leading to crime as well, a lot of crime.
Sorry, I'm just going to take a break.
It's not because I'm a big fan of crime, but I just... Have you? Okay.
Second part of the interview with Pavani Reddy. Well, before we get into different functional areas of police reform and restructuring, I'd like briefly to ask you about what's a typical day as a gender advisory for UNDP, but seconded to the Ministry of Gender, looks like.
Typical day... Well, mostly I work on the policy side of things. So there's a lot of policies that are currently being undertaken in the country, from social welfare to national. So there's very, very diverse policies that are currently being undertaken, currently being developed in the country as well as revised in the country. So gender being something very cross-cutting and so. It's almost like we have a little insight or little inroads into every single policy that's being developed in the country. And participation in some of these policy developments becomes a bit of an issue, given that there's a limited capacity, both in terms of personnel and in terms of resources. And therefore, we do prioritize on the kind of policies that we can focus on. So for now, we are very much focused on the social welfare policy that's being developed, and as well as very interested in ensuring that the security sector reform that they're proposing, the one that's been adopted as well, is the implementation of it is quite sensitive to the gender issues in the country, as well as the PRS implement the poverty reduction strategy implementation that's going to roll out from June onwards. The implementation plans actually reflect the strategies that are proposed in the poverty reduction strategy, particularly in terms of gender. Okay. That's from the gender technical advising side.
And just to give us a rough idea, what does the gender ministry look like in terms of capacity right now? How big an institution is it?
It has a lot of staff, but it doesn't really have technocrats in it. So that is the biggest challenge we face, and that's why people like me need to be seconded to the ministry to work as their staff. And sometimes it becomes difficult to differentiate where my role as a UN staff and where my role as a ministry staff ends and begins. Because the ministry might have a set idea on a few things, and where that might be a little, not against, but a little different from what the UN is proposing. So it's always a slightly different. When that happens, it's difficult to negotiate that ground.
Well, actually, we'll come back to this in the end of the interview, the relationship between the UN and the host country personnel. But I'd like to go into the first area that we're looking at, and again, from a gender perspective, which is your area, the recruitment of the police. How do you participate in the recruitment strategies, the designing of the recruitment strategies at your level?
I personally don't, and I wonder if the ministry as well does. Though we should be following up very closely, because this has been a time and again a very important issue identified by the women themselves. I mean, it's something that we strongly feel about in terms of from a technical standpoint or from a philosophical standpoint, but it's not something that we are actually doing in terms of following up with the recruitments, following up with the LMP as to whether or not they are actually following through what was decided upon in the 2004-2005 in the restructuring of LMP. Are various strategies that we have proposed are actually being implemented? I mean, it's really hard to tell because there's not just enough staff to go around to follow up. We need like a separate staff just to be able to follow from the security sector reform point of view. But I don't know if I mentioned cross-border trade and the problem that we have in terms of the security sector and cross-border trade and the abuses of women in the cross-border. Did I tell them?
Can you develop?
There's a lot of cross-border trade between Liberia, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, as well as what's the other country?
Guinea.
The anecdotal evidence that we have that is being repeatedly recounted by various sections of the populations who are engaged in this cross-border trade is that the cross borders have posts of police, army, immigration, and they always get stopped at these cross borders. They get checked, bribes, as well as rape and other kinds of abuses take place. And so much so that it is actually hindering cross border trade. And this has become to a level that it was discussed as well as a priority issue that needs to be handled by the government right now, and how we train or how we influence the security sector actors to train, not just train, but follow through with their training, is going to be very crucial in the next couple of years if we want to make a big change in terms of what the services that security sector is providing to the people, the quality of the services that it's providing to the people.
We'll get back to training, but first on recruitment. Mm-hmm. You're not directly involved in following the recruitment strategies. Mm-hmm. However, I mean, there has been one of the big challenges of the police because of the history of the police and the public perception, just to get people to apply. Mm-hmm. It's been even greater a challenge for women, to get women to apply to the police. Is this something you've... you've been the gender unit is aware of, the gender ministry is aware of,
yes.
and what are some of the initiatives that have been taken?
We are definitely aware of this. Is something that we constantly hear every time we go to the security sector meetings, that it's become really difficult in terms of recruiting qualified women too, because there are other options that they can go in for. And I mean, I don't blame anyone for mistrusting any forms of state power, particularly police and army, given that two decades of war, it was police and the army that committed the maximum amount of abuses. And to recreate that kind of, to recreate any kind of trust in these institutions of power, is going to be a long run, and I think LNP needs to needs to advocate more in terms of getting more people, getting more qualified people to apply for these positions. But I understand that the Americans who are supporting these LNP restructuring, they do go about take the women. Officers from LNP as well as the army, and they have more of an information sessions with the women in the counties to encourage more women to apply. This is definitely done through the army, but it was more of an initiative of one of the advisors of the armed forces. It wasn't an initiative from the armed forces itself. It was one of the advisors to the armed forces who made it a point to take his very, very qualified women candidates and take them around and encourage them to be role models to other women and get them on board to join both the army and the LNP. And the next question that you need to ask is, LNP has 23 women in the top positions. The Inspector General, the Deputy Inspector General are all women. Then what is stopping these women to take much more of an active role in terms of recruitment, in terms of being out there actively enrolling candidates and actively encouraging women to participate in LNP? And one of the proposals that we have is to extend what we call reserved officers training corps. Which was a program before the war, which was basically an officers training program that's introduced in the schools to extend to young girls, as young girls and women as well. So you have qualified women being trained in high schools who will at a certain point join either the army or the LNP, so that you have trained qualified candidates available readily. Because they never had a strong standing army, and I don't think that's a security ambition of Liberia either, to have a strong standing army. So they used to go through the reserved officers training for reserved ROTC. That's the program.
Okay, ROTC. Like, yeah. So, but this is in high school.
This is enrolled out in high school.
During the high school, so you do partly you study and the weekends, or you do army training. Would that be specifically for the army only, or is that something that would be considered for the LNP as well?
I think the proposals are that we need to look at how best to introduce it to women, girls, mm-hmm. and how best to use it as a starting point for getting more in all of the security sector, mm-hmm. police, army, maybe specialized units.
You mentioned the IG, the head of police, and her deputy being female. The president is also a woman. The UN brought in a whole contingent of Indian female FPU. There's definitely been an emphasis in gender, particularly in the security sector. Has this had any visible impact, if not measurable, in terms of perception, or is it too early to tell? Is there any feedback you're getting on for instance, the Indian all-female foreign police unit?
But their presence is very much in Monrovia, though. I can't really tell.
how they're perceived outside in the counties, because it seems to be all the presence of the women and women in security are very much concentrated in Monrovia. And when we're discussing Liberia, we're not discussing Monrovia. And that's my perception of it. I would be very interested in understanding, hearing what the FPU think about how they're being perceived and if they have made any real tangible change in terms of the number of women being, because and that's not true. We have about maybe one woman right now in the specialized officers training in police academy right now as we speak. So she wants to leave as well. That's what I heard yesterday.
You have one?
One female in the special unit that's being trained at the LNP.
The ERU, the emergency response unit?
Uh-huh.
It will be carrying weapons, the only unit.
Yeah,
with the SPU, they would be carrying weapons.
That's right, and there's only one woman in that unit, and she wants. And as I hear it yesterday, someone told me, looks like she wants to leave too.
So she's in the middle of the training right now.
Yes. Again, this is anecdotal, not that I spoke to that woman. So you need to again cross-check with someone who can actually verify that
right.
fact.
No, but there was. Yeah, it's something that other people mentioned, that there's only one woman currently in this mm-hmm. unit. They would potentially carry weapons, basically. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now that leads us to training and professionalization. We've talked about the sort of accelerated education program to bring some women to high school level so that they can actually enter the training at the police academy. What are some of the trainings that are specifically on gender, human rights, and how do you make sure gender is mainstreamed into the training that the police officers and army receive?
That's a very interesting question, and I think I have not ever seen a training manual for the police or the army, so I'm not in a position to say whether or not it's appropriately gender mainstream, or even from my perception, whether or not it has anything in terms of how you treat men and women, or how do you understand what they're saying, or how do you differentiate, how do you understand the differences of men and women from that standpoint? What does gender training mean? I don't know. I've not seen the manuals. I don't know their curriculum. I think the best. This question should be directed to Anmol, who's actually involved in gender mainstreaming or gender training in.
So UNPOL, for instance, has a gender unit.
That's
so
supposed to be.
And you work with them.
Again, it's the capacity issue is humongous. So it's me. Basically, that needs to follow through all the sectors. So,
you mean you're the only gender person at UNDP?
No, it's from the ministry's point of view.
Yeah, from the ministry's point of view. Okay.
There's a lot that's going on in the country. There's absolutely humongous amount of work that's being done in terms of everything. So following through, if you don't have dedicated staff to look at the security sector, is going to be difficult. And we are really urging for if not an expert, at least someone with this familiarity in the security sector to hire someone like that, so that they can follow through with from the gender point of view. But again, the training manuals, we had this discussion once at a security sector meeting. The Ministry of Defense said, oh, it's all gender mainstream, they get training in gender and human rights. Our Deputy Minister said, can we see those manuals and at least know that what you're teaching is just not, there's a man, there's a woman, they have differences, but you're actually teaching the police and the army to be able to engage with men and women on an equal basis. The response we got was, it's, how do you call it, not secret, but what's the word? The access is limited. It's not for everyone's consumption, the training manuals. So
national security.
Yes. It's a matter of national security. Our training manuals will not be shared with everyone. So
this is for the Army.
This is for the Army. But the LNP has a
curriculum that's been developed jointly by UNPOL and LNP.
And there's an UNMOLD Office of Gender Advisor as well.
And okay, who looks at all these issues? So, are there any other specific issues in terms of training that we haven't talked about?
Not that I am aware of. If I can think of anything, I'll get back to you on that.
The next area in terms of restructuring of the security sector is integration and amalgamation of services.
Mm.
What are some of the discussions and what's the gender perspective on this restructuring of the sector?
As I understand it right now, there is definitely going to be the armed forces and LNP, right? And of course the minor arms corrections, the immigration, all of that will fall under the security sector, which don't have the same power as corrections and immigration would not have the same power as LNP or the armed forces, but they are at a lower level in the security sector, but they have a huge influence, particularly when it comes down to cross-border trade and other kinds of cross-border issues. Amalgamation of services, it's not more of an amalgamation, but rather the nature of services that they're going to offer. That is a key concern to from a gender standpoint, particularly LNP. We're not looking for a traditional policing as it was done 20 years ago, which is basically police stand around, if there's any crime, they investigate. But we want much more of an active role in police, in terms of community policing, in terms of them being able to patrol in community, build community relationships, improve their citizen-police relationship, more of on the crime prevention side of things, with basic human security as the core principle that we want them to follow, rather than police being seen as someone who would stop crime and keep law and order, but much more of an engagement with the community in terms of that I think that reduces the pressure on the police to do everything as well. And reduces the need for them to carry arms. I think.
In the beginning of our conversation, The first issue was to increase the representation of women in the security sector. The second was to make services offered to women and people more friendly.
Mm-hmm.
One big initiative was for the police to create what they call the Women and Children
Protection Division.
What are some of the achievements of this section? How far along are we in the actual services they are offering, and how was this unit created in the first place?
I can't really answer to how the unit was created and the training that they underwent, but I can definitely state that the concern right now is that the Women and Children Protection Division is based in the headquarters of LNP, making it in terms of access, very limited to the services that they can provide. As in, it's women and children are not just in that LNP building. They have probably one car for the unit.
So the unit is based in the LNP headquarters building. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Are there some branches in the police stations?
Yet. Not yet that I'm aware of, because that was also a point of discussion yesterday when we were looking at the security sector, and the information that I got was there's just no presence of them. And not only that there is no presence, there is no capacity of them for them to do the work. The head of the Women's and Children Protection Division, I believe, went a couple of weeks ago to PV Hospital somewhere out in the counties, and that was the only car available, and they had a child rape case. A girl of 5 or 10 was raped repeatedly, and they didn't have a vehicle to take her to the hospital, or vehicle to go and arrest the perpetrator who was just walking around the streets, or do anything about it, because police didn't have the means to go and arrest this person, or even for the girl once she's in the hospital to offer her appropriate services and even in psychological services. This is just normal police, not just the Women's Children Protection Division, but that shows you the limitations of them being able to perform the role. And I've known a couple of police who trained the women, who worked with the Women and Children Protection Division, and who trained them as well. And the information I got from them is it's very easy for people, for normal police officer to view any of the women-only cases, whether it's in terms of, particularly in terms of abuse cases, when they come, oh, it's something that needs to be dealt with Women and Children Protection Division. It's not our case anymore. It's just being pushed over when it becomes like a concentrated, specialized unit, definitely, but then the rest of the police are not aware of its work or don't take the responsibility of saying, well, that's a crime committed that I'm equally responsible to do, to follow through with the investigation and arrest and things like that, but they just pass it on to Women and Children Protection Division. As I understand it, it's a constant training that goes on job training with the Women and Children Protection Division, particularly by UNPOL, in terms of them understanding why they need to do certain things, why understanding certain things are more important, how they talk to the survivors or victims, however you want to call them, how they talk to them. I mean, so it's, and how they do bookkeeping, how do they, what do you call it, the first incident reports, FIR, or how they file these things, and how do they keep all the evidence. So it's a constant on-job training. So I don't know what the turnover of the Women Children Protection Division is. That would be an interesting thing to find out.
What the?
Turnover. So
is this unit staffed with officers that rotate in and out of it?
I don't know. I mean, but I'm presuming if any man placed in this Women Children Protection Division might request for a transfer. I mean, they can definitely request for a transfer and can move into other divisions. So I want to know whether or not, or for that matter, any person can request for a transfer.
Or if it is on a volunteer basis that you join this unit. The next area is internal management. You mentioned the fact that the IG and DIG are currently for the police, so the number two positions are staffed by female, but they're presidential appointees. What are the issues of, what are some of the management problems in terms of, from a gender standpoint,
again,
in the police?
Again, this is a very much an anecdotal information that comes through in terms of what's the difficulty in working in currently the working conditions, the difficulty in the working environment in LNP right now. I'm not sure if I should be quoted on this at all, but as I understand it, there's a lot of rivalry.
Turf battles.
Which makes LNP a more politicized and makes new initiatives that this country really provides an opportunity for. I mean, you have like a clean set. You can create a police system that could be studied and could be duplicated in other countries and you have an absolute clean state. But the initiatives that anyone proposes or can propose, or even if all the heads can sit together and discuss, that the initiatives that they can come up with is limited because there's no dialogue that's taking place.
Oh, you mean at the very top level? Because right now all the middle management below the political appointees.
Even them, they said 23, there's not real discussion between any of the, not just the high level, but also one.
But these are all provisional positions because there'll be a promotion board that will soon review all the ranks.
Hopefully.
And so on. Mm.
So that's been a limitation in terms of working with the LNP.
Because the any effort on gender might not be, if it's supported by one, might not be supported by
any
other.
Any effort, irrespective of whether it's gender or not, any effort might be, because there's definitely, you need to ask yourself one question. Rape is the highest reported crime in Liberia. And a rape is not a crime that usually goes reported. So if it is the highest reported crime, then you can imagine, you can multiply it by probably 10, 15 times and understand what the figures are. How often do you see campaigns by LNP in terms of prevention, protection, and even awarding people or even training police in order to, all police in order to address crime? It's very limited, and you need to ask yourself, why isn't this not taking place?
So now we've explored a number of different areas of police reform. In your opinion, what are and from your gender standpoint, again, what are some of the tasks that should be prioritized? What are some key...
In terms of police reform?
Yes, and maybe broader, on the broader gender
but
perspective.
I don't know, I mean, maybe you can enlighten me on this, but do they have a clear strategy in terms of... They've developed a police strategy in terms of this is what the services of the police, this is how the policing will be? I don't think so. No. Okay. Because I think that's going to be key for us, because we really, really want to push for more of people-centered, people-friendly policing and focus more on crime prevention. That is going to be the key from a gender standpoint, because the services that that police are offering is pretty abysmal right now. So that needs to be very, very much improved. And for that to take place, and for more women to join, they need to look at their own institutional reform in terms of codes of conduct for police, in terms of having a sexual harassment policy for the police, because they do go about doing most of the crimes out in the counties. And also in terms of how the human resources policy, in terms of how they encourage more women to join the LNP. Now, it's one thing to have these policies, and it's another thing to have mechanisms in place to address the violations of these policies. And given the infrastructural difficulties in this country, given that of the sometimes the police presence in the counties is very, very limited, because they don't have proper access to roads. It's very difficult to travel to some of the leeward counties. So the police presence is very, very limited in the counties, and also, there's no oversight from Monrovia once you're sent into the counties. So you can do whatever you want basically in the counties. So with so much limitations, any proper functioning of a police force would be no less than 10 years. And sometimes we fail to see the entirety of the picture and concentrate on getting fancy words on the paper and we fail to understand it. We fail to see the gravity of the situation and the actions that need to be taken immediately.
So, last section of the interview. Now, I'd like to turn to the donors and the UN, and maybe the first question. In terms of, you're co-located in the Ministry of Gender. A lot of the strategy of the UN, and particularly the UNPOL, has been co-location, working within the LNP,
mm-hmm.
and working together with them on the job. What are some of the lessons you've learned from this, and maybe advice you may have for people in similar roles?
Sometimes there's so much pressure to finish few things by a certain deadline, which is yesterday, so therefore you need to crunch it today in order to meet that deadline. So it doesn't really give an opportunity to mentor staff, at least from where I stand, as in on the, from the policy side of things. But I'm sure UNPOL functions very differently, and they do go, they don't do work, but they're supposed to mentor staff and give them on-job training. But I think another big challenge is also, I guess we have the luxury of education and the luxury of an exposure and a luxury of understanding these are the structures of government that needs to be in place in order for these to function. But you can't expect someone else who's just graduated from high school, gone through 20 years of war, so with a very limited exposure to what, to the overall global functioning of the state, to understand why you're saying certain things, why these things need to be done, and which is a gradual process. And I think when that particular sense is not there in the people whom you're working with, sometimes they don't understand why you're saying what you're saying, and what's the rush? Why does this need to be done today? So that, in terms of whom you're working with and their understanding of why these need to be done, that's a challenge. Or for that, it comes out as disinterest. I don't think it's disinterest from their part, but it is more of not understanding or not having a fuller picture of why it needs to be done, the way it is done, and why it needs to be done now.
If you could create a wish list, what would be two or three changes in UN, and specifically UNDP, internal management of policy, that you would wish for that could help you do your job more effectively?
I would not wish for anything to change with the UNDP, because it's not UNDP's job, but it's more on the ministry side, in terms of having more technocrats. Because a Ministry of Gender's role is to be a more of an advocating body and a monitoring body to ensure that the kind of changes that need to be taking place are actually taking place, and if they're not taking place, be able to provide technical assistance to do that. And that's not taking place. I mean, UN only can advise, and it shouldn't be doing the job, because when UN leaves, it's no follow through.
The gender ministry is sort of a an innovation here. Some countries gender mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
Some countries, other countries have went on the option of a gender ministry. Are there some? When was the gender ministry created? And are there some lessons already from the, having taken this route?
I'm tempted to say 2001. I have a mandate somewhere. But that I could be totally wrong. It's definitely late 1990s, and early 2000s that it was created. It is definitely a new body, the Ministry of Gender and Development, that it's called. I think it's an important ministry, particularly because if it has to play that oversight role, it has a very, very important role in terms of addressing issues of marginalization and exclusion, whether it's from male or female. And it is one ministry that can actually address something like this. Lessons learned from having a ministry of gender. Again, it goes back to the capacity of ministry of gender to actually do its role. And how do you address that other than just have like good staff, or have a ministry should have internal capacity building programs so that it can train its own staff to do its work. It's also the ministry which looks at child welfare and development as well. So it's a very, very key ministry.
Maybe last question. Mm-hmm. Are there any innovation or experiments that you know of from your current job or other places, previous experiences, in terms of gender and security sector reform, that you think merit more attention?
Say that again?
Are there any innovations or experiments that you know of in the area that we've been discussing that you think merit more attention, that we could learn from?
I don't know about experiences in other places, but we're definitely advocating or pushing for having a civilian oversight body. First, initially we thought it should be a gender oversight body, but a civilian advisory / oversight body to the security sector, and whose role would be to ensure that the trainings that are provided are actually gender human rights sensitive. They actually are going through with their gender capacity program. They're actually recruiting more women. It's more of an oversight to see if all these that they've agreed to in terms of the strategy in security sector reform are falling through. And also be able to have the issues of civilians being addressed by the security sector. And we also think it's a very, very important committee, because Liberia definitely, given its history, requires more of a civilian oversight in its security sector. It shouldn't be just something that is directly being addressed by the president. Because once this president leaves, the next president might not be the same. And in order to balance that out, we definitely want to have a civilian oversight body. Whether or not that's going to be, we have a feeling it's going to be a long drawn out battle, because we hear that there are lots of outside security actors who are reluctant for an suggestion, who are reluctant to put in place a suggestion like this.
For what reason? And what are some of the outside players?
I'm told it's mostly Americans.
But what are the specific reasons? Why would they be reluctant?
I guess they see it more, the security sector should be more just an institution that's well-trained, well-disciplined, and much more do their mandate or fulfill their mandate. They don't see the importance of having a civilian oversight, probably because they don't report, their security sector doesn't report into anyone other than the Secretary of State and the Chief. So,
but they also have been focusing their part of security sector reform on the army side.
Yeah.
They've not taken a lead role in the police.
No.
Or are they institutions?
But any civilian oversight body would deal both with LNP
and the AFL.
I mean, it would deal with the security sector as an entirety.
Okay.
Because the army is also supposed to be training its officers in gender, and making them much more sensitive to gender concerns, because once they deploy to the border areas, they would also be a part in the checkpoints. So again, we don't want issues of what we are facing right now in terms of cross-border trade to escalate once the AFL is there. They are, of course, paid very little. And we should be able to question the Ministry of Defense as to why he thinks his soldiers are doing what they're doing, and why, what has he has to say in an answer. So, yeah, it's going to be a long, drawn-out, very fun battle. We'll keep you updated on that.
Do you have any final comment? Okay. Pavani, ready? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arthur.